Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Can't hear you, Mr. Sharkey. Your Ben Jarofsky Show for Tuesday, September 7th is just moments away. But before we do this, we need to thank our sponsors. Sponsors like SEIU Healthcare, Illinois, Indiana, the Chicago Federation of Labor are sponsors. The Chicago Teachers Union, they are sponsors. It's true. And Chicago Reader. ChicagoReader.com for all things there is to know the city of Chicago, where to go, what to do, what to eat, what to drink, what kind of movies to see, what kind of pot to smoke, and so much more. Chicago Reader, ChicagoReader.com. Subscribe, and you can check out columns from our very own Ben Jarofsky. And if you want to help out this program, you can. ChicagoReader.com/Jarofsky, J-O-R-A-V as in victory, S-K-Y, and you can become a Benhead. Find out more information, ChicagoReader.com/Jarofsky. It is Tuesday, September 7th, and live from my apartment and his attic, this is the Ben Jarofsky Show. Today on the program, Bruce Williams returns, and also making his return, Legal Eagle, Attorney Jim Coogan. And now your host, not a Legal Eagle. Chicago Reader columnist Ben Jarofsky.
Hello, everybody. Ben Jarofsky here. We're calling this Magic Man Tuesday, and here's why. I was going to call it something else. We had an abrupt change of plan, so here's my old script. Just going to throw that old script away, okay? Remember Donald Trump doing stuff like that? It worked for him. He got to be president of the United States. I'm just going to rip up this. Remember that day when he ripped up the script? Started throwing it away. There's actually parts of Donald Trump's presidency, folks, I'm now going to confess that I kind of miss. I mean, just the idiocy of when he took the, they're never going to show. Remember when he was like, the stands were full and he was accusing the TV people of never showing the full.
Oh, anyway, he's still doing that.
They won't show. Anyway, Magic Man Tuesday. We have a little troubles connecting with our Magic Man guest, the great political activist out of California, Bruce Williams, who came on the show once before to explain what is looks to us on the outside as utter freaking madness, but in reality is rational and logical, is going to work to the advantage of Democrats. I'm just going to keep saying that as my mantra. Anyway, for a while, it looked as though we weren't going to hook up with Bruce, but the Magic Man, Dr. D, the pride and joy of Alton, Illinois, the man who receives approximately $1.5 million to produce this podcast every month.
It's true. It's true.
I don't know what he did, you know? It was like horse whispering. And next thing you know, Bruce Williams is here. So, Bruce, forget the opening script. Let's get right down to it. Welcome back to the show, young man.
Thank you, Ben. Thank you very much. I'm very happy to be here.
And I have to tell you, folks, before we take the deep dive, we're a show that goes from center left, and some of our on the outer fringes are our guests and listeners cannot stand the Democratic Party, are always railing on me to be harder on the Democratic Party. Folks, you guys would love this. And behind Bruce, there's a huge poster of Hillary, and it just says Hillary. And I don't think he's being ironic. OK, I think the man loves Hillary Clinton. So anyway, Bruce, I'm doing my best to interview you and call you Bruce without suddenly calling you Hillary, because I got this picture of Hillary right behind me.
Yeah, man. I can't change that circumstance. That's a beautiful artwork that was done in the 2008 election when Obama's famous Shepard Farley the Great Hope poster.
Yes.
This was the Clinton campaign's counterpart to it.
Oh, yeah. That's bringing back memories. Good God.
Yeah, and I just put it in a beautiful matching royal blue frame and hung it up because she lost.
Well, yeah, she did lose. Barack Obama defeated her. And I must confess, I voted for Barack Obama, but that's ancient history. Let's move on. Let's talk about the election that's about to occur. In California, actually, voting has already started. It's a recall election. And Bruce was so kind to come on the show a couple months ago to explain it, take us from A to Z on the madness of recalling Governor Newsom, the proposal to recall Governor Newsom. And here is the part that just ordinary voters, Bruce, this is where they trip as they leave the gates on this one, because if you're voting yes to Newsom, you actually have to vote no. So I think that was a big problem from Democrats right at the start. So just explain that, how a no vote is actually a yes vote. Take it away, Bruce.
Yeah. So, and that happens on a regular basis every 2 years in the California process of propositions on the ballot. It really depends on the way the question is worded. Right. So in this particular question, the question is, shall Gavin Newsom be recalled from office as governor of California? Yes or no? So those of us who support Newsom and oppose the recall have to say no to the recall, because the question on the ballot again is the recall. It is not shall Gavin Newsom be governor. It is shall he be recalled as governor, and the answer to that, of course, is no. So the Newsom campaign is the no on recall campaign. Stop the Republican recall. Anyone who wants to recall him votes yes.
And so that's the message they've been putting out. Now, I don't remember if this poll had come out the last time you're on the show or just after. I can't remember. I've lost track of all time.
Yeah.
But there was a poll that just freaked the hell out of Democrats and anybody really left of center that showed a very narrow margin between those who were going to vote to actually recall Gavin Newsom and those who were going to vote against recalling him. I believe that poll was like 48 to 47 or something like that. You told me about a new poll that came out that may give some of my liberal and lefty listeners a little more encouragement.
Yes. So that was about 4 or 5, maybe even 6 weeks ago, that initial poll. Once the recall qualified and was placed on the ballot, the most respected polling organization outside of L.A., the UC Berkeley Public Policy Institute, or if you hear me say UC Berkeley PPI poll, indicated that those who opposed the recall were at about 48 or 49%, and those who supported it were at about 45 or 46%, give or take the margin of error. Mm-hmm. And anecdotally, I will always remember this moment. I was at my neighborhood grocery store, and this young 20-something cashier was looking at me. This is probably in July as I'm checking out. And I have this huge sticker that says, protect progress, reject recall. And she goes, what's recall? And it scared the bejesus out of me that this person didn't even know what the hell was going on. Yeah. So here we are in 1 week away, and over the weekend, UCPPI released another poll. And sure enough, the no on recall Newsom campaign is actually getting some big traction. The poll shows that 58% of likely voters, whatever that means, are going to vote no to keep him in office. And the number of those voting yes has dropped down to 39%. Now, whatever the percent that's left over is still undecided. Mm-hmm. And in most elections, undecided votes tend to, if it's this late, they tend to vote, they tend to protect the status quo. They tend to split evenly, or they lean slightly to the status quo. If that's the case, the supporters of recall are doomed to defeat. Mm. Now,
go ahead.
Mm-hmm. This isn't poll information, but I would also point out that according to the LA Times investigative research into the California Department of State's numbers for ballot return rates, the ballot return rates in the heavily blue and liberal San Francisco Bay Area are up to over 30% ballots already returned. Down in Los Angeles County and Southern California, they are in the high 20s, and similar rates of ballot return in, let's say, more red counties like Fresno County, Bakersfield, Kern County, Riverside County are down still in just double digits, like 13, 14, 15%. Those rates 1 week before the 2020 election were very similar because Democrats in California, everybody gets a mailed ballot, period, no matter whether you ask for it or not. And Democrats tend to, during the pandemic period in 2020, and still now with the Delta variant, are using the mail-in ballot. Of course, the yes on recall people are all anti-vaxxers. COVID is a hoax. No, they hate masks and vaccine mandates. And so they're all waiting to go in person, which is fine. That's their prerogative. And I'm sure that, you know, they'll show up on election day. But they are still outnumbered 2-1 in this state. And so the real issue with the Newsom No on Recall campaign has been just engage our voters, bring the coalition together, and get the vote to turn out. And as I mentioned a month ago, now you see Bernie Sanders on television and in digital ads with ads to vote no. You see Elizabeth Warren this weekend. Kamala Harris and Joe Biden are going to be in the state. So the entire width and breadth of the party has come together. The California Federation of Labor is doing, since August, has been doing phone banking 2 or 3 nights a week. Phone banking and text operations on weekends to voters, and it's clearly starting to have an effect in my experienced opinion.
Now, you predicted this, by the way, just for folks to know this, at the most dire moments when Democrats and liberals were freaking out, Bruce Williams was predicting that the Democrats ultimately would prevail. So let's just talk a little bit about the that poll. I realize it's just a poll. So
yeah,
but it went from neck and neck to a significant lead for the no campaign. What do you attribute that? I got a number of theories. That just the first one in my mind is that people actually figured out what a no vote means and what a yes vote means, which is just the very basics. But what do you attribute the reversal, if you will? It was neck and neck, and now it's 58 to 39. Go ahead.
Yeah, I attribute it to 4 basic dynamics. One, the Newsom campaign, the Republican recall campaign got their shit together and clearly messaged it as a Trump-inspired right-wing attempt to overthrow the will of the voters from 2018, and that they wanted to take, it was the only way they could win, was in an off-year recall election to throw out the Democratic governor of the bluest state in the nation. So secondly, the campaign was clear in just say no, just vote no. Don't even bother with question number 2, which is, for those who may not know, there's a second question on the ballot where 49 different candidates are listed. And the question is, if the governor is recalled, who shall be elected to replace him? And so that question can be answered with just a plurality of the vote.
Wow.
Now, but the point is, the campaign focused on just say no. It's that clear. The second or third factor at work here is several things. It's hard to run against 49 different people, right? Most campaigns is this candidate A versus candidate B, right? Mm-hmm. But in this instance, Newsom was struggling with, how do I run against 49 people? Because the question is really, this is just about me. And instead of promoting me, like, you know, the message hasn't been, oh, I've done a great job and was the victim of circumstances. No, the message was, look at this crew, this motley crew of no name, no nothing, right wing people who want to replace me. Just think about that. So that worked. That worked. And then emerged at like a week, a day before the filing deadline, Larry Elder, the one candidate that anybody who is informed about public policy development and elections in California knows, has been a talk radio host in the LA metro area, and now he's syndicated nationwide. Everybody knows Larry Elder and his absolutely awful views. He thinks the minimum wage should be zero. He thinks women are too stupid to be in politics. He has a former fiance who has accused him of brandishing a weapon when they were in an argument at home, and so on and so forth. He's got a whole journal of quotes that would turn any, even the most moderate Democrat mad. Third, so Newsom began to campaign against Elder to use him as the face that he will win, because the first poll that we were talking about showed him with 18% out of all those 49 candidates. He was leading the field with 18. So they made him the target, and he's an easy target. In fact, he's got a bunch of golden eggs laying on a golden platter and just handing it to the Newsom campaign, which they wielded against him quite effectively in all the campaign ads. Third, you've got the Delta variant, which has continued to threaten the health and the safety of the public across the state and in very obviously many other places across the country. And so now the message has been tweaked a bit to say, save our health. Say, you know, if you vote yes to recall Newsom, you are going to be handing the state over to a person who's anti-vaccine, anti-mask, wants all the public schools open and the kids to be unmasked. That's not a good thing to do when the Delta variant is out there working its magic. Finally, the great gift was the United States Supreme Court deciding just a few weeks ago to not enjoin the Texas legislature in passage of its anti-abortion law that rules it out after just 6 weeks. I mean, women don't even know they're pregnant at 6 weeks from what every woman has told me. So all of those things combined, that same poll that I was just talking about last week, this past weekend, showed that of those likely voters, 66% of all the female voters, 66% are voting no, because they do not want abortion rights in this state to be impaired. Mm-hmm. So all of those things have kind of combined to completely transform the dynamic at work.
By the way, I wonder if you'd have a similar conversation with that woman at the grocery store, wherever it was that you said, would she know what the recall election was?
Oh, that's a great question, because you know what? About 4 weeks later, right? From then to now, I encountered another young woman. I'm sorry, I always frequent this grocery store. And I was wearing the Gavin button. And she goes, oh, yeah, I just sent in my ballot today. And I went, yeah, I was smiling from ear to ear like this. Now, that told me anecdotally that it was getting through. It was getting through. Because now she knew about it.
Wait, it was the same person? The same?
No, it's not the same person, but the point is it's the same location.
Yeah.
The same demographic group or age group. And she was aware. Mm-hmm. That's just an anecdote. But that said to me, it's getting through.
Yeah. By the way, when Bruce said the Supreme Court action in Texas was a great gift. He did not mean, and I'm speaking for Bruce here, and I think he would agree, he did not mean it was a great gift to the country or to women or to anybody. What he meant was that it scared the hell out of Democrats in California. So in that sense, it was a great gift to the Newsom campaign, but it was not the ruling itself was not a great gift.
Just that is exactly what I meant, and I appreciate that. Thank you.
All right. And this gets at the heart of the decision not to have a plan B. By the way, great flick I just saw over the weekend, Plan B. Want to urge everybody to check that out. But going back to the California election, the recall election, and Bruce and I talked at length about this the first time he was on the show. And what I mean by this is that the Newsom campaign decided that they were not going to have a candidate, a prominent Democrat, in the second part of the election. The question, too, among all the candidates running to replace Newsom, if people voted to recall him. And their reasoning was that it would just distract from the first part of the campaign, which is the first question, which is to vote no. Man, it does get confusing, Bruce, I have to tell you. So at the time, I was questioning that strategy, and Bruce strongly countered me by saying it made sense to him. So we had a mini debate on that show. Do you still stand by that, Bruce? Do you think it's still a good strategy not to have put a plan B, not to have a stronger, more recognizable Democratic name in the for question number two?
I do indeed. I think that the progression and evolution of this question is confirming my belief that was the right call. And I would also add, not as a clarification of what you said, but as an addendum or footnote, that it was not just the campaign who was urging Democrats to stay out, but it was the entire Democratic establishment who swept in immediately, like I said before to you a month ago, that when Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren came out publicly and endorsed Newsom immediately, that said to the progressive wing, look, we cannot split. We cannot have a Democrat on that second question. We're all going to get behind him because we cannot afford to have a Republican governor elected in this state with a plurality. So then the second thing that I think confirms my view is that it allows for the very clear message, just vote no. You don't even have to vote in number two, because a lot of voters think that if they vote no, they can't vote in number two. But some, even well-meaning Democrats and progressives, vote no on recall, but just in case, I'm going to pick somebody over here.
Yeah.
And that's the whole candidacy of a young 29-year-old guy named Kevin Fofgraf, who is a Democrat, registered Democrat, though I have to say he ain't no Democrat at all. He's more of a libertarian, really. Mm-hmm. He made his millions in real estate, and now he has a YouTube. He's got like 1.6 million followers, and he wants to give every public school student $2,000 to go into, he calls it his Future Schools Initiative. It's the same as the private school vouchers. It would simply drain public education of more money and send kids into trade school so they can get a good job. He's a good capitalist, and he wants those kids to get a good job. So, to make a long story short, to circle back to your question, I'm absolutely confident that that strategy was correct in 2021.
Now, have you already voted, Bruce?
My ballot is sitting on my coffee table. It will be in the ballot box sometime this week.
All right. I'm urging you to hurry up and vote. Did you vote for a candidate in the second question, or did you leave it blank?
Left it blank. There's nobody there that I would even consider voting for. Yeah.
And by the way, folks, I have to tell you, Larry Elder, we could do a whole show on how insane Larry Elder is.
Thank you.
Bruce, I'm a little embarrassed to admit this, but from time to time, I would know to go down the YouTube rabbit hole, like every day, go down that rabbit hole. And over the weekend, I spent a little too much of my life watching Larry Elder clips on YouTube. Man is freaking. He had this one exchange with Candace Owen, who was this far right, Trump loving talk show host, where they were talking about reparations. And he was like, you know, and let me just preface this. Larry Elder is a black man and Candace Owens is a black woman. He goes, you know, when I think about reparations, slaves were actually property. And they belonged to somebody, slave owners. So when you talk about reparations, you know, at the end of slavery, you really should be talking about giving reparations to the slave owners for the property they lost. So he says this batshit crazy thing, Bruce, and Candace Owens is nodding her head like, oh yeah, I hadn't thought of that. I'm like, wow, this is just some, I mean, I know the world is crazy right now. The people taking the deworming or horse deworming pills left and right, firefighters in LA proclaiming that it's a loss of liberty if they have to get a shot. It's just the carnage, ongoing carnage in the city of Chicago. It's just an insane world out there. But this one, I don't know. Some points of that, you just got to laugh at it, Bruce, when I watch Larry Elder and Candace Owens discuss giving reparations to the slave owners for the loss of the slaves.
I couldn't agree with you more. That's why I indicated one of the very first gifts to the Newsom campaign was the emergence of Larry Elder at the last minute as the overwhelming leader of the PAC. Out of 49 candidates, he's now up to like 31% support. Now, the other 48 have to just, you know, dole out the crumbs.
Yeah.
So he's an easy target. I couldn't agree more, Ben. Yeah.
All right, we are going to take a break, say goodbye to Bruce Williams. Just farewell, I should say, Bruce. One way or another, we're going to bring you back after the votes are counted. Either it'll be a victory lap where you're saying, I told you so, or it'll be, I don't know, we'll be crying and drinking and smoking reefer or whatever just to get over it. But we'll bring you back to do an analysis of the results. Are you good for that?
Absolutely. Thanks so much, Ben. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Bruce. Appreciate you taking time to talk to us. We're going to take a break. When we return, the great attorney, Jim Coogan, will be on, and he'll be explaining the Supreme Court ruling regarding Texas. Good luck with that explanation, Jim Coogan. We'll be right back with Jim Coogan.
Hey, everybody. We're back. Welcome back to the Ben Jarofsky Show, live from his attic.
We've left the madness of the California recall process, and we're going to enter the madness of the Supreme Court decision in the Texas abortion law case and other legal issues with our favorite legal advisor, Jim Coogan. He's also our favorite White Sox fan, and he's been on the show the last three times, Jim Coogan, I think it's been, talking about White Sox. So now we're going to not talk about the White Sox in any way. We're going to just resist that temptation, other than to say, man, Robert looks good, doesn't he? But wait, I'm sorry, we're not going down that path, Jim Coogan. So welcome back to the show, and we're going to talk only about law, okay?
Good to be back. Good to see you both, Dennis.
Hey.
Although I heard the lead-in, I'm not here to defend the Supreme Court's decision, just to help probably explain it. I heard it sounded like you're going to, you know, good luck with this one. I appreciate that, but I'm not sure how much I can do to defend it.
Yeah, no, I didn't mean to suggest. We'll just edit that out, of course, and the editing process that never takes place in the Ben Jarofsky Show, where Dennis corrects my stumbles, and I think he actually, Jim, just adds more in there when I'm not looking. All right, Jim Coogan, wow. I don't know what's worse, the Supreme Court decision not to enjoin the law or the law itself. So why don't we start with the law itself, and then we'll move on to the Supreme Court's decision in the case that was before them. So take it away. Just describe for folks the law itself.
Yeah, so this is definitely the next in a long string of anti-choice and, I guess, anti-women's health strategizing from different legislative groups outside, because, you know, these laws, for example, this kind of law, lots of other laws that have been used to create constitutional challenges over the years, specifically in the area of women's health and abortion care, aren't always the product of some particular legislator in Mississippi or Texas or Florida or wherever. They have outside people who help them with these things. They have outside groups that spend a lot of money advocating for these things. So this is the in a long series. Trap laws have been the subject of lots of constitutional examination over the years. That was a method of trying to gum up the works and make it impossible to provide abortion care by putting all kinds of regulatory restrictions on providers. You know, they'd say, if your clinic is more than 100 miles from a hospital, then you're not nearby, you're not close enough. Or the walls in the hallways have to be 18 feet wide to comply with hospital standards, even though they're not doing hospital type surgeries there. They're doing other types of procedures, making it so that if your main provider didn't have hospital privileges at the nearest hospital, that you couldn't provide these services. And then the hospital just would refuse to offer those privileges. So these were clever ways designed to kind of sidestep Roe versus Wade and the protections on a woman's right to privacy that the Supreme Court announced in that decision, that allows women the ability to do things in the best interest of their own health without the hand of the government coming down and telling them what to do. You know, traditional small government advocacy here, Ben. So this Texas law is actually really, well, it's very clever, but it wouldn't have been so effective if the majority of the United States Supreme Court didn't willfully go along with its conceit. And by that, I mean, here they've done something creative. Instead of having it a situation where regulators in the state of Texas or county prosecutors would be the folks actually enforcing this law by, let's say, prosecuting a provider who performed an abortion 7 weeks after the woman's last menstrual period, which the 6 week number is one of the things built into this law. Instead of having it so that the Supreme Court could then say, yep, we're going to enjoin, that's what injunction is, the words are related, basically a court stopping activity before all the merits of the case have been decided. Supreme Court could say, wait a minute, this is blatantly unconstitutional. It's inconsistent with Roe and Casey and everything else that we've been saying since this 1970s. So therefore, state actors, you people who are acting under the color of law, you may not do anything until this has been decided on the merits, fully briefed, and that might take a while. And in the meantime, this law can't be enforced. Instead, what they did was they made it so that it's sort of like privately licensing bounty hunters, because it's essentially saying anyone can have standing to bring a lawsuit against not just the provider, not just everybody that works at the clinic, not just the woman involved in this, in what probably is the most difficult decision she'll ever make in her life, but even somebody who may aid or abet this process. So in other words, an individual dude who's creepy enough to sit there and stake out an abortion clinic can take down license plate numbers and just start filing lawsuits against everybody who pulls into the parking lot, which the Texas legislature has decided he could get $10,000 if he successfully reports somebody and they find that the person actually was in violation of this statute. So that's really one of the biggest wrinkles that we're dealing with in this one, Ben. It's this private enforcement mechanism. So a few minutes ago, what I said was the Supreme Court's majority went along with this, because if you read the decision, which is about two paragraphs long, there's just a remarkable statement by the majority here, where it says that the antecedent, legal questions presented here are so novel that essentially they can't really address them at this point in time. That there and that the Supreme Court doesn't have the ability to enjoin private citizens from taking actions, and therefore their hands are tied. They can't do anything. They're just completely befuddled by this. We've only had a Supreme Court for 230 something years, and they've found ways to enforce the law when necessary. But here they have been completely flummoxed because of this ingenious application of the law, which really isn't all that ingenious, and it really isn't all that novel. but it's was designed here to create just this kind of a, I don't know, of a conundrum. And the five justices have sought, have decided that they're going to go along with it and pretend that their hands are actually tied.
Yeah. Now let's just pause for a moment and to confront the issue that I'm always presenting to you. It seems like whenever we talk about Supreme Court rulings or any judicial ruling, and the jaded, cynical observer of Chicago politics generally says to you, a judge only concocts a decision to sort of justify the opinion he had from the get-go. And they're just, they're all politically crafted documents to uphold that judge's worldview. And sometimes it looks as though I'm wrong with my jaded observation when a judge very rarely will rule in a way I didn't expect. But this one sure looks that way. Jim, you just read their ruling, two-paragraph ruling, where they effectively say their hands are tied, there's nothing they can do about, which just seems to me to contradict the central point. If you're facing a novel law, the first thing you would do is prevent the state from enacting the law because you want to determine, you want to think about whether it is constitutional. I've never heard of it. I don't know. You help me out here. I've never heard of a judge saying, well, yeah, I don't know what to do with that one, so I'll just let you do it, whether it's legal or not legal. And to me, it's just like, how they just said, how can we come up with a couple of sentences to justify taking away abortion rights in the state of Texas, because this is what we want to do. And they just cooked up this two-paragraph response to solidify something they already wanted to do. Do you think I'm being too cynical and jaded in my interpretation?
No, not in the sense that I think that these justices were ready to do. Well, the broader idea of, you know, sometimes I think it's improperly framed in the media, either in the Supreme Court justice side of it or just general politics media, where the question was, well, will they overturn Roe versus Wade? What about overturning Roe versus Wade? Are you going to over? Nobody has to overturn anything. They could either decline to follow the precedent, which this shockingly does. For the court to go along with anything where they're just this is a very short, there's three dissents and a two or one and a half page, well, I'm putting opinion in quotes because it's not really an opinion. It's just a statement. It's an order. It's a ruling. They basically don't have any direct statement about the merits of it or anything else. But what they've done, they can't pretend like they don't understand the impact of what they're doing, overturns 50 years of their own precedent, their own decisions. So it's not enough. It's falsely framed to be concerned about whether adding another justice would have led to, or even asking Amy Coney Barrett in her confirmation hearings, whether or not she believes in that. And I'm sure she said something vague and unspecific about following precedent, because every judge can pay lip service to that in a confirmation hearing. But this, clearly, nobody even bothers to argue at any point that it wouldn't be constitutional if it were just a normal law. They're basically saying here, you know, the statement, one of the few statements they make, federal courts enjoy the power to enjoin individuals tasked with enforcing laws, not the laws themselves, which is also not, it's true that they have to enforce, like, in order to enact the enjoining of or injunction of a law, you have to stop somebody from doing something. But they could say that this demands additional constitutional scrutiny. They could say the most obvious thing, which is this by itself sets aside our own precedent that we've been ruling in a certain way for 50 years.
Yeah.
So, of course, they already knew what they wanted to do, and they wouldn't go along with this kabuki theater of acting like they can't take any action here unless they wanted to.
Yeah. Were there any of the judges that signed onto this kabuki theater? That's good. Good line. Wish I thought of it. Were any of the judges a surprise to you? In other words, were you startled to see like Gorsuch joining this force or any of Kavanaugh or Thomas, anyone, any of them a surprise to you?
I think that one thing that it's easy to fall victim to, or it's easy to fall into this trap, is when people just have kind of an overly simplified characterization of what they think each justice is about. They're not automatons. These are human beings. And sometimes they will do things that do actually support and uphold the just and equal application of the law. Like when we saw Justices Gorsuch and Kavanaugh signing on to the basically correct answer in terms of the turning over of the president's tax returns, because the law has to, they clearly in some, they aren't going to just universally undermine the authority of the courts and the laws themselves. So they're trying to do both. They want to be faithful to the causes that they obviously also support, such as limiting woman's choice, but don't want to completely look like they've just given up. So there's some nuance to some of these justices. Justice Gorsuch has wrote a very powerful opinion defending Native American rights, which was, I think, surprising to people. Because, again, if you just kind of pigeonhole them and assume that a conservative bad guy is going to only do these things all the time, it's obviously going to be too simplistic. Here it was 5-4. Justice Roberts joined with the presumptively liberal wing of the court in the dissents. But you could explain that a lot of different ways. If that's if that's political maneuvering to try to appear as if, well, you know, I'm not going to be a hardcore partisan on every issue, but it still has no practical effect because there's still only 4 votes. So signing on to these dissents, or he signed on to 1 dissent, 2 others that he didn't join from Justices Kagan and Justice Sotomayor, it doesn't really mean anything because there's still 5 votes in favor of it. So he may have even looked at it and said, well, I'll continue to look as if I'm the neutral arbiter here and I'm not just a partisan, knowing what the other 5 justices were going to do anyway.
I think, Jim, you've been hanging around me too long. I totally, completely, wholeheartedly agree with you on what John Roberts was up to. And I completely agree with the unstated part of what you said, which is that it's a political act, just like the others were making political acts. And I've always thought, we've had this conversation about Roberts before. He's what's left of moderate Republicans, and he doesn't want to push the Republican Party too far to the right. I think that was clear when he made that the ruling that upheld Obamacare.
Yeah.
And I think he's just been replicating that decision in one case after another. And I agree with you. They are political animals. I'm just going to make one slight correction to what you say, or take issue. You said the majority are trying to limit a woman's choice. I would say they're trying to eliminate, not limit. Women's choice. When you say that abortion is illegal for 6 weeks, you're effectively outlawing abortion because, as you said, most women don't know they're pregnant at 6 weeks. So they're trying to eliminate. Wow, the shadow agenda. This is something we've gotten so used, Jim, to Supreme Court decisions coming down in the spring. You know, these major decisions, like what, in May and June. I remember you coming on the show. We were talking about them. There's, you know, which we would be talking about. What is the Supreme Court going to follow Trump, et cetera, and so forth? And then out of nowhere, we get a major decision. In early September. So something is up here, and I think it was confusing to a lot of people. And that's this notion that you can make big time decisions without what? Hearings, arguments, briefs, like all the stuff that we thought was required for big time decisions. Talk about this.
Well, sure. So there is a Supreme Court docket. There's a process. They choose the cases that they want to have briefed every term. They invite the parties then to brief, you know, very substantial legal briefings that may include all kind of, beyond the merits of the underlying case. There may be all kind of a much broader assessment of authority and precedent from state cases, from prior federal cases, They're very thorough review of the law, because the Supreme Court, as the final arbiter of federal law in this country, has a great amount of discretion. They're not bound just by some narrow decision about whether something was properly applied at the original trial court level. Whether someone's constitutional rights were infringed under the Fourth Amendment in a seizure or something else, or whether death penalties in certain cases might constitute cruel and unusual punishment under the Eighth Amendment. So because they have such enormous power, we're used to big full briefings, amicus briefings, which is a Latin word for friend of the court. Interest groups of different persuasions will submit things to the court, arguing sometimes in more legal terms, sometimes in more social policy concerns about why they should rule a certain way and what impact it's going to have on American society. None of that happened here. The law was passed in, I think, at the end of July. It was set to go into effect midnight, September 1st, 2021. And there had been some initial pleadings, I think, at the trial court level that led up to early September. But by the time it was set to take effect, nothing substantial had really happened. And the Fifth Circuit, which is what the federal circuit that includes Texas, I think had done nothing with what was before it. So an application was made to the Supreme Court on an emergency basis saying, if you don't do something right now, this will go into effect and it will you're right, I would agree with you, completely eliminate the ability for a woman to seek abortion care if that's the thing that they need, which, again, knock, knock, Supreme Court, you guys have been saying for 50-something years that that's supposed to be their right under the law in this country. So you need to take some action. Otherwise, taking no action would ratify something that completely undermines your authority. Mm-hmm. Again, instead of doing anything else, they went along with it. And so this question about what is a shadow docket, it sounds kind of mysterious, but essentially there can be a legitimate function with a body as important and powerful as the U.S. Supreme Court, where they can sometimes make certain rulings, have certain orders, where it doesn't require that full-blown briefing, where it's not that entire process. So it's not necessarily a pejorative term to say there's a shadow docket. However, it's a question of how it's used, when it's used, under what circumstances, and whether it's used consistently. Something that was highlighted by, I think it was Justice Kagan's dissent, was the one that said that this is an abuse of an inconsistent method of using the shadow docket. What she's referring to is that under a lot of circumstances, the Supreme Court would say, well, you know, this is the kind of thing where there are substantial rights at play, and we shouldn't be just offering short, quick decisions. That's not how we work. That's not how the most august legal body in this country ought to work for something of great precedent that affects the rights of millions of people. But that's exactly what they're doing here. And before you take them at their word that, well, their hands are just tied and they can't do anything, they, the Supreme Court, especially during the Trump administration and in the last few months during the Biden administration, has made, the statistics are such that they've made much greater use of this system of just ruling with a 5-4 opinion where there's no actual full-blown opinion. And specifically, they are very interventionist when it comes to cases where the person who's saying that their rights are being infringed is saying it on a religious basis. Several cases during the pandemic where a group was saying, we're not allowed to have church, but they're letting the drugstore down the street operate. Yeah. This is an infringement under the First Amendment, and these regulations cannot be allowed to stand. The Supreme Court didn't say, well, you know, this is a public health issue, and we have to defer to the governors because, after all, this thing is killing hundreds of thousands of Americans, if not millions of Americans. So we're not going to get in the way here. But if you want to have, we won't rule on an injunction. But if you want to rule, have a full-blown ruling, maybe we'll take this case up later if you can prove that you actually had your rights infringed upon. Mm-hmm. They had no such compunction in several cases like that. And their use of these kind of injunction orders, it's gone from, I read some statistic, it was used maybe 5 times in the course of the Bush and Obama administrations. They used it 28 times during the Trump years. So these are, again, these are situations where there's much less public scrutiny. nobody's reading about it for a couple of weeks leading up to it, where it's in the general news and people have a chance to maybe have some understanding of what the heck is going on in the Supreme Court's docket. So their use, I mean, just by those statistics alone, has skyrocketed.
Yeah, and it is pretty, I don't know, it does seem pretty selective. I know one conversation we had a lot, we talked a lot about was whether Donald Trump would be forced to release his taxes. And I remember almost every ruling, we broke them all down, Jim, a bunch of them anyway, they would enjoin the prosecutors or the congressional investigators. You know what I'm saying? Well, we're ruling that you have the right to it, but we also realize that there are these outstanding legal issues, and we're going to allow Donald Trump to protect his tax, to continue to conceal his tax returns while judges hear this, the matter. So if you're just an ordinary citizen trying to make sense of it, it does seem rather selective.
That was dealing with the financial, I guess, privacy rights of one individual. Okay. And here, this is affecting, I don't know, what are there, 25 million people in the state of Texas?
Yeah.
And it's not just people in Texas. It's going to affect other citizens because I assume it's already happened where other states where they have been trying to eliminate women's medical rights are going to copy this pattern and pass the same law.
Well, there's like three issues that I've taken notes on that I really want to talk to you about. And let's just start with a political question before I get into the bounty hunter question and the copycat laws that will come. And the political question is this. If you're a Democrat and you watch the behavior of those five justices who just did away with abortion rights in that one ruling, at least for the moment. But that's where we are right now. Other states can pass similar laws. And if the vote is the same, they can eliminate abortion rights in many states across the country. Is your sense that the time has come to add justices to the Supreme Court to sort of take away the all or nothing dilemma we face where, like right now, Stephen Breyer, what is he, 83 years old or what have you, and already Democrats are saying, retire, retire. I remember they said the same thing about Ruth Bader Ginsburg, retire, retire, because if you die while you're in office, while a Republican's in office, then it'll be a lifetime of hell. So do you think the moment has come when Dems should take a movement toward adding seats to the court?
Well, I have no doubt that, and I believe the Biden administration they've announced, I don't know how far they've gotten into the process, but they've announced that they want to have some sort of panel to examine changes that can be made to the Supreme Court structure. There's important things to consider here. Number one, the United States Constitution does not state that the Supreme Court must have nine justices. It's a product of, there is a law that's been passed, a statute by Congress that relates to the number of justices, how long their terms would be, and how they used to have more situations where they would circulate and actually some justices would rotate on and off the court. There's been other setups over the years. So the questions of how long their terms are, the number of justices, and whether or not there's any rotation of who actually sits on a given panel for a given case can be changed. Those three things are not set in stone. They needn't automatically be the case. So your question is specifically about adding a number of justices. I would say this. I don't think there's enough people in the Senate, given the size of the country. I don't think there's enough representatives. I mean, what is it, 825,000 people per rep in a state where it's big enough to have more than one rep, like Illinois. That's how many people my representative, Jan Schakowsky, has to keep in touch with. It's preposterous. I mean, it's literally impossible. So furthering that, the notion that nine justices could really be a representative sampling of the greatest, even the cream of the crop, greatest legal minds in the country, is it really reasonable to say that really just nine represents that whole group? And only nine of them are going to have the power to decide cases at this level. I don't know that it makes sense. Franklin Roosevelt got bad press, I think, initially for being labeled as, you know, he wanted to pack the court simply because they disagreed and kept overturning his New Deal legislation that was being passed by a very Democratic House and Senate at the time in the 1930s. But back then, would the country have like 100 million Americans? Now there's triple that. Would it be? I think, frankly, it would be very reasonable to say, let's add justices. And why does it have to be the same nine justices in every case? I don't really understand how that, first of all, in a democracy, the notion that those nine people have no term limits, they can't be, the ethics rules are so twisted that they really can never get off the court unless they choose to, or they have health or death comes to them. So that's it. They can't be removed for, I mean, impeachment would be a meaningless exercise, I think, under any circumstances, even though it's theoretically possible. So why should you know, sitting here right now, if you're filing a lawsuit, you know exactly who your court's going to be every single time. Even that's, now granted, that's true at state levels as well, but maybe that ought to change. Illinois has seven justices. They just reconfigured the allocation by district as to how many voters are in each district because it had gotten so skewed. I think there's a lot of merit. I know Ro Khanna, he's a representative from the state of California who is very in favor of this, some kind of change. I think they ought to add justices, and I think there ought to be a mixture, whether it's 7, 9, 11, pick a number, that decide any individual case on a randomized basis so that you might actually see some diversity of opinion. And I think that, frankly, there'd be more legitimacy to those decisions. Because right now, this body has become so partisan.
Yeah.
It didn't do anybody any favors, unfortunately. You think transparency being a good thing. But the moment that the Supreme Court confirmation hearings became televised, which I think was Robert Bork was like one of the first ones in the 80s maybe, where this stuff would be put on the nightly news and people would start to look at it. From that point on, it's become so partisan and so transparently partisan that I think that that's hurt American justice ever since that time. You know, you'll see something in the news where, oh, back before whatever, 1986, justices who were appointed by Republicans actually voted in favor of some law that upheld a social policy that was, you know, it was a little bit less predictable because they were finding people who were just good jurists and maybe not just hardcore partisans. That, for anybody who actually pays attention, is that ship has sailed so far out of port, is gone.
Oh, yeah.
So,
and by the way, on a tangent here, tonight will be the start of Ryan Murphy's 10-part series of the Clinton impeachment, which began out of Clinton's affair with Monica Lewinsky, which I will be obsessively watching. I must confess, I don't know, Jim, if you're going to watch it, but I've many thoughts on this, but I've really turned against Bill Clinton for many reasons over the last 10 years or so. Every year it seems I turn against him more and more. I find him a repulsive political character. But whenever I say this to Democrats, more often than not, the response is he appointed Ruth Bader Ginsburg to the Supreme Court. And I'm like, well, you know, he did do that, you know. But that just underscores the stakes that you're alluding to. Do you follow what I'm saying? It's like that one appointment was so important because she held office for so long and could evolve as a powerful advocate for things that I believe in and I think you believe in. But then, she stayed on too long, and so she died. She's been replaced by an automaton who's complete opposite of her. So it just underscores how insane the system is in some ways, if you follow me. Like, I'm supposed to absolve Clinton of all his wrongdoings. Well, he'd put Ruth Bader Ginsburg on.
Well, at best, you could say it's to rebut my general notion or argument that this has become a very anti-democratic institution, not because the individuals are anti-democracy, although maybe a couple of them are, but because of the way it functions and because of the way it is populated, that the stakes are just, they're so arbitrary as well. It's not, you know, it's not even, there's no uniform application. So even to those who might challenge Biden and charge him with a scheme to pack the courts, what happened at the end of the Obama administration? They left a seat open for 10 months in order to keep their fingers crossed that maybe a Republican would be president in 2017 and they could fill Antonin Scalia's seat with whoever they wanted to. And then, of course, Justice Kennedy voluntarily resigns with some, I would say there is some legitimacy to the questions as to his connections to Trump and finances and some of this other stuff. I don't want to be overly conspiratorial, but it certainly, it opens the door for these very convenient, well, you know, now's the time to step down. We'll make sure we get somebody very young to take my seat. And of course, poor Justice Ginsburg dies a month and a half before the election, and they jam through a confirmation in 2 weeks, I don't know, something like that, to make sure that Barrett gets on the court. So, yeah, that whole sequence that I just described is preposterously arbitrary. It's certainly not any kind of the will of the people. Maybe we want to keep the system in place where presidents appoint these jurists. Maybe we don't. But that in and of itself is already one level of removal, not to mention the fact that there's an electoral college, so there's already another level of removal. And yet that is the pathway for choosing Supreme Court justices. That really doesn't seem very democratic. Yeah. Not to mention that the folks who are in control of it right now represent the interests of maybe 38% of Americans.
Wow. And it's not democratic in a lowercase d democratic in any way. And the justices that Jim was alluding to who were won seats on the court are, of course, Kavanaugh, Gorsuch, and Comey. And these are the justices who were appointed by Donald Trump because of all those circumstances that Jim just ran down. And Donald Trump, one more time, did not win a majority of the vote in 2016. Let's just add that part to it. Exactly. All right. And so the result of those three justices being added to the court by during the Trump era was a law that essentially makes citizens of Texas bounty hunters. I find that one really disturbing on many levels. Because it just suggests, I don't know, a certain amount of lawlessness, if mm-hmm. you follow what I'm saying. And it's so bizarre. I'm talking to Jim Coogan, who is a trial attorney. And for years and years, this thought just popped in my mind, Jim. For years and years, the Republican establishment has been going after attorneys like yourself, trial attorneys like yourself, saying you're everything that's wrong with the system, and you're over flooding the courts with needless lawsuits. And now the hypocrisy of Americans. Now these same Republicans are encouraging citizens to do just that: flood the courts with lawsuits. Let's just talk a little bit about that, Jim Coogan.
Well, you know, just on a human level, I will address more of what you're saying. But before I say that, I want to point out, on a human level, this seems like a bad idea, because you're talking about a human combination of people who are in a very desperate situation. I know there may be exceptions to every rule, but I refuse to believe that the vast majority of people who are seeking an abortion are not in such a desperate situation that they've finally determined this is the only thing that they can do for their life and for their health. Okay, so let's start with that premise. Now you're empowering, the law is saying we're not even going to get involved in this. People who have badges and training, and we're supposed to be protecting the health and welfare of the citizens of Harris County or whatever place in Texas, we're not even involved anymore. So we're deputizing anybody and everyone to go be probably, don't you think this is going to lead to confrontations? Yeah, I mean, there's already been bombings, murders of abortion providers over the years. There's already, you know, they have to put up chain link fences outside of the clinics because people who are overzealous about this will get out there and get in people's faces, throw things at them, threaten them, write down their information, dox them by putting their information on the internet. So it's already a heated situation that's extremely confrontational. Now you're saying, you know what, on top of which, we're going to hand out $10,000 checks if you can go and catch somebody in the act. So, yeah, it's kind of perverse, and it definitely turns the law on its ear. And as far as filing frivolous lawsuits, I will have you know that I've paid attention to the statistics over the years, and injury lawsuits are a very small fraction of the civil suits filed in this country, Ben. But you probably already knew that, and maybe your listeners did too. The notion that, yeah, our kinds of clients are the ones filing frivolous suits or clogging the courts has always been an absolute joke and not supported by any evidence. But this will definitely lead to all manner of frivolity. I mean, you can't, who knows who's going to, so for example, you file a lawsuit in federal court, there's a procedural rule, Rule 11. There's an Illinois version of that, but it's a little bit, there's less teeth and it doesn't get enforced as often. But if you file a frivolous lawsuit, you can be penalized.
Yeah.
Courts can fine you money. Now, I don't know if there's going to be some lawyer down there who's going to, you know, broadcast far and wide, come to me with your quote unquote whistleblower cases and I'll file them for you. Or if people are just going to do this pro se, it's probably going to be nuts the way that this actually gets enforced. Assuming, of course, that maybe the real impact is already going to happen, which is people will stop going. Clinics will shut down, and maybe there won't be anything to report because the prospect of these kind of civil penalties is so great that it's the other reason why this law will effectively destroy Roe versus Wade without even touching it.
Yeah. By the way, I think everything you predicted will happen, has the potential of happening anyway. In other words, it will have impact absolutely on the availability of abortion in the state of Texas, no doubt in my mind. I do believe some quote-unquote enterprising lawyers will make this their business. I think there's money to be made for this if the law is, in fact, ready to go through. And then there will be all kinds of this will be weaponized by neighbors who don't like their neighbors. So this is it's just bad from start to finish. I can't see any good coming out of it, with the possible exception of going back to my last conversation with Bruce Williams from California, who's saying that it's been a rallying cry for people who are against the gubernatorial recall. In California, saying, okay, you see Texas? Larry Elder could do that here in California. So other than that, Jim Coogan, I can't see any good coming out of this. And you sent me something as a text today that really struck me. You alluded to the Dred Scott case. 18, what year was that? 50. I'm trying to do the late in my 50s. Memory. Yeah. It's the late 1850s. I was as old as I am. Even I wasn't born then. But having to do with forcing slaves to return to their owners, and there's a certain amount of that kind of psychology in this bill. Don't explain a little bit what you meant by that when you said that it reminded you of Dred Scott.
Yeah, I mean, you know, a different era. So there's a different reason why they're effectively deputizing anyone and everyone who wants to enforce this law for them. They're doing it for different reasons here. Because in the 1840s, I think the actual Fugitive Slave Act was passed in 1850. So up to that point in the 1840s, you have a border effectively between slave and free states running across the middle of the country. And there just wouldn't have been enough manpower. Or if you were, let's say you were a slaveholder and one of your, what you see as possessions ran away, it's hard to just hire a bounty hunter of your own. Maybe they don't know where to go. Instead, pretty much anybody would be empowered to potentially enforce this if they knew someone was actually a slave, if they suspected them of it, of, you know, there's a black person in Indianapolis and they're thinking, well, they're not from around here. I wonder where they're from. There was the possibility that they could be, you know, tap into a bounty network and make some money off of it, report to the right person, get a payoff from that guy. And this way the law wasn't going to go enforce it. They couldn't send state militia from the state of Kentucky up to Indiana, or that would have started the Civil War. So they basically was a way of using private individuals to enforce a heinous legal scheme that the decision in the Dred Scott case, which was such a disgrace for the United States Supreme Court, upheld that law, even in a situation where the person was in a free state and basically said, hey, this can't apply to me at this point. I'm not in whatever state that I think they originally came from and therefore it can't be constitutional to enforce a law across state lines like this. But that was the Supreme Court's decision at the time. Effectively, the echo that I heard between the two is that instead of actually using law enforcement to do something that is morally ambiguous or just deplorable, but at, you know, at best, the advocates are going to say, "Oh, slavery is just a Southern institution, and we're just defending it. We're not passing on the merits of it. This is just the way it is." It's kind of the same thing. You know, you're talking about people who are in a desperate situation, and rather than having sheriff's deputies go do something and stand behind the law that you want to pass, instead they're kind of just washing their hands of it and letting the, I don't know, the marketplace take care of it. Which is always a dangerous thing when you're basically delegating law enforcement powers. And I think that's an extremely dangerous way to run any kind of a serious legal system. And that's exactly what's happened here. And that's exactly what they're doing.
All right. So we'll close with this. The Supreme Court says they ruled that they can't enjoin the law, so they can't block them from implementing the law. So people who are opposing the law legally, what's next? Do they return to the Fifth Circuit? Do they file back to the Supreme Court? In other words, the Supreme Court didn't say that this law is constitutional. It just said we can't block it. So what's next for opponents of the law?
Well, I guess the challenging part is for someone who, let's say they turn out to be 9 or 10 weeks pregnant, they realize they're pregnant for the first time and are seeking to get an abortion, it's very difficult for that to become a test case for a lot of practical reasons. They may be deemed as not having standing to challenge it because, I'm just trying to think about how that would work. The person who would definitely have standing would be somebody who is actually sued under one of these bounties situations, gets reported, and actually has to pay a $10,000 fine. I would suspect that the more likely mechanism is someone may voluntarily do that, let themselves be the ones who's going to be at the mercy of this law, and allow that to get appealed and then appealed again, and probably almost definitely end up back in front of the United States Supreme Court again on the merits. So in that situation, you would have somebody who actually got penalized this $10,000 civil fine. Because the practical impact with someone actually seeking an abortion, if that's what they really need to have happen, in all likelihood, they're going to have to seek that somewhere else, have it happen. And therefore some court would say, well, you don't have standing. This isn't an issue for you anymore. So you can't really challenge this law on the hypothetical basis that you might seek to get this care in Texas. So it's probably the latter of those two. And that can be it. I mean, in all likelihood, well, I guess the legal and political strategy behind that, they'll probably have to think that through, because of course the risk is that this does get ratified, that it's upheld.
Yeah.
That for some reason beyond the facial merits of it, that the deeper merits, that there's still a 5-4 majority that's gonna upheld this, I would say, dangerous and undemocratic and unelected group of bounty hunters going around enforcing the law. This whole system that Texas has endorsed here could be found to be constitutional somehow. There might be a case where it effectively overturns Roe versus Wade in a more permanent fashion. Again, probably without actually challenging the merits of the right to privacy. They would just say that, hey, we made a regulatory scheme. We decided that here's the cutoff line, and we're not even enforcing this. The people of Texas are.
Yeah. So I guess the only hope for Texas is demographic changes, which we've talked about in the show a lot, turn Texas from the Trump state that it is, the MAGA state that it is, to a blue state, and then they could pass new legislation. And you watch, suddenly the Supreme Court will find its power to enjoin. you watch that. Anyway, Jim, I will say this, we'll end on a, for me anyway, a positive note. The one other thing that I note that the legislation has done, some very encouraging sort of what, civil disobedience, if you will, on the part of people who are flooding the complaint lines with bogus complaints of people violating the law. I don't know if you've seen this, people. Yeah. So, like, you know, I could say, well, I saw Donald Trump drive a woman to an abortion clinic. And so you accuse Donald Trump or Donald John or Donald Trump Jr. or somebody like that. So it is inspiring resistance. And ultimately, I think political resistance, it's what it's going to take, Jim Coogan, to eradicate this law.
I mean, I wish it didn't require these kinds of threats to individual. This is a real threat to individual liberty. I know that's liberty is the buzzword of the right wing pundit in this country. But honestly, this is an actual threat to individual liberty. This is big government. Controlling someone's sexuality is about as big government and intrusive as it gets. You know, a regulation on how old you have to be before you buy a gun is not really an infringement on your liberty. It's probably a reflection that your prefrontal cortex hasn't really finalized until you're 28 years old or whatever for a man. I'd say take it up to that age for possession, but that's a whole different ballgame. But, you know, I mean, maybe you're right, Ben. Hopefully your guest earlier is right that California voters are awakened by the actual threat as opposed to just ignoring these threats. And they go vote accordingly. You know, democracy is a very imperfect thing, but assuming that you're allowed to vote and your state hasn't taken that right away from you yet, you can still do something. You can still go cast your ballot and at least make your voice heard at the ballot at that one time a year or every 4 years you get the chance to.
Yeah. By the way, you just reminded me how worthless libertarians are on matters of real liberty. The only thing the libertarians seem to be really cared about these days is the liberty not to have to take the vaccine. But meanwhile, women down in Texas, you lost your liberty. And the state, the Supreme Court won't even come to your aid. So, all right, Jim Coogan, thank you so much. It was fun talking law with you as opposed to talking White Sox, which is also fun. But I have to ask you one White Sox related question before we let you walk out the door. Are you heading into September confident about the Chicago White Sox chance? Or are you heading into September looking at the bullpen, the seventh and eighth and ninth innings, getting a little nervous? Are you confident or are you nervous?
What worries me is they got a lot of injuries on what had up to this point been a very solid starting pitching staff. Position players, all these guys who missed a lot of time. I think the cycle is all kind of coalescing in a good way. The position guys all seem to be healthy and they should be. We'll see how that staff looks in 3 weeks. If they can get healthy, that's what matters most. I mean, that's something you really just can't predict. I think some of the scuffling lately I can live with. Hopefully they just get them on the right pathway at the right time.
Yeah. By the way, I'm going to give another shout out to Tony Lewis. I thought he's done a great job managing the White Sox, but I'm not going to allow this to head into a White Sox discussion.
Another time.
Another time. Thank you, Jim Coogan. Great job as always. Also want to thank Bruce Williams calling in from California, talking about the recall election in California. If you're a Democrat, it's a little good news. He predicts victory. And I also want to thank the man, the myth, the legend, the pride of joy of Alton, Illinois, without whom this show would be possible. And it's Jim Coogan and Bruce Williams who tell you back home in Alton, they call him Dr. D. Give yourself a raise.
Quick question, Ben. Petty cash. Cool question. Before I take it out of petty cash, no first Tuesday tonight?
Oh, no first Tuesday tonight. Absolutely no first Tuesday. I shouldn't let the cat out of the bag. Maya, my partner in crime, just got married, was on her honeymoon. So congratulations, Maya. And yeah, everybody wishes you a great honeymoon. I think she just got back. So no first Tuesday for September. So thank you for saying that, D.
All right, now give me that money. I'm taking it.
Now go back to the petty cash and take your money. And have a great day, everybody. See you tomorrow.